Pollock versus Virginia State Bar, Exwell 7th District. Bradley G. Pollock, Kevin N. Rose, Appellant's Counsel. Robert S. Claiborne, Jr., Appellee's Counsel.
Okay, may it please the court. I'm Kevin Rose with the law firm Bach & Rose in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and I am here on behalf of the appellant, Bradley Pollock. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Let me start my argument with where I kind of ended in my reply brief, which is that courts speak through their orders. And when I look at this case, it all comes down to this petition that was filed by Mr. Pollock, and whether or not that was due, you know, with you know, his candor to the court and truthfulness and with respect to statements in that petition. And in this case, Judge Ide and the circuit court judge, in his order, you know, we all understand that the attorneys will prepare the orders and submit them to the court, but nevertheless, the court ultimately has to review those orders and approve that they agree with them and enter them. And that is, in fact, what Judge Iden did. And it says that Mr. Pollock filed the petition in good faith and for the benefit of Ms. Kearney.
Would that ruling in that case bind the disciplinary court in the disciplinary case? It doesn't seem to me logically that it does.
It's the most relevant piece of evidence we have, because they're basically, their position is that
That wasn't the question, sir. Justice Russell asked if the disciplinary board, disciplinary court rather, would be bound by that.
All right, bound by it, I would say, I guess no. Is it relevant? Yes. Okay. All right. So to me, it's the most relevant piece of evidence.
If I could take you back to that, though, sir, that's a legal conclusion, yes, that he filed it in good faith. And if it is a legal conclusion, is that something that we have to accept?
I think it gets back to what your point just a minute ago was on binding. I would say no. I think it's just a piece of it's evidence that's relevant of
what
we're looking at.
If it's relevant, then what we know is that he basically put it in the order himself, and the guardian ad litem and the other lawyer, they were just wanting to get this monstrosity over with, and so they signed it so they didn't have to go back to court and expend more fees arguing over whether or not and to what extent it was filed in good faith.
I understand that, and in that situation, we're going back and I guess second guessing orders and taking them not for what they say. We still look at, to me, I'm looking at this from an evidentiary standpoint of what is the evidence that what Mr. Pollock did that was would meet the standard to violate the rule. And if we have to look at that, we can't bring Judge Iden to the courtroom to ask him, you know, do you feel like he did not exhibit candor to your courtroom? Because he can't be a witness. But the only place we see him where he can actually be a quote witness is in his order, because he signed the order, and that's the only evidence.
Well, how much evidence was taken on that point? In other words, was there a hearing where one side said, hey, you didn't have good faith, and then the other side said, I did have good faith, and there was evidence presented, and the court made a resolution of that? Was that the case?
No, that was not the case.
Okay.
But nevertheless, the finding of the judge is that there was good faith. Now, and that's obviously, I'm assuming in this case, my recollection looking at it, I say assume, but I think my recollection is Mr. Pollock prepared the order. So he wrote it that way. And so the other attorneys did not, I say attorneys, one was a guardian ad litem, an attorney serving as a guardian ad litem, they did not object. One of them indicated that he didn't even read it carefully. He just cared about the fact that it had his amount he was supposed to get paid, so he signed it. The other attorney said, as you did, he mainly just wanted to get this over with. Well, that's all fine and dandy, but you're
turning
still...
Turning to the substance of one of the allegations. Mm-hmm. My understanding of the record, and you correct me if I'm wrong, is Mr. Pollock claimed the ability to act in this woman's stead based on a power of attorney signed on July 6th.
Okay.
And then when he decided not to tell the court that that had been revoked, it was his position that he didn't believe that she was mentally competent to revoke it. The revocation occurred on July 12th, a mere 6 days later. Does the record reveal anything that would suggest she was competent on July 6th and had become incompetent by July 12th? Because that seems to poke a major hole in his whole premise.
That's a good point, because there is not anything. And in fact, If you recall, when the state bar investigator interviewed the guardian ad litem and the attorney for Ms. Kearney, they pointed out that the pleading being frivolous for the reasons you state. And it had to do with there not being any medical support for it. So we get into this issue of the concern to the attorneys and even the judge. They pointed out when they interviewed him that Judge Item brought made the comment in open court that he was concerned about the pleading being frivolous. But the concern of being frivolous had to do with being there not being any medical support or any evidence like in that time frame you're talking about. And so that distinction is, so we go from a pleading being frivolous and the concern being with the lack of medical support, and also the other concern was is the guardian ad litem had spoken to Ms. Kearney and didn't feel she was incompetent, so that was raised as well. And also Mr. Allen, the attorney, her attorney, had done the same. So the concern was there, but the concern was not with this issue of a purported power of attorney, where it uses the word purported and brings up to the court's attention that there's something called into question about this power of attorney that he's attaching to the petition.
Well, right, but the naked use of the word reported with nothing else. If he was going to challenge the revocation in the proceeding, you would think he would note that there had been a revocation. You would also think that there would be something if he says that the one on July 6th is valid, the one on July 12th is not. He has to have some basis for asserting that, doesn't he? And yeah. Other than it helps him do what he wants to do, there's no evidence to suggest it.
And I would agree with that, but I look at that as not being what the basis of why he violated it. My understanding when I read the three-judge panel's decision is it's focused on him leaving out some of this evidence of like not putting in the revocation, but not it's the focus is on the power of attorneys and not like the medical records, which they were saying was why it was frivolous. Like, where is this lack of to show that she actually was incompetent? So I guess I'm looking at the, to me, I don't see a concern from what I could see from the investigative report or interviews and what they said, Judge Iden said, courtroom, the concern with being frivolous was more with her condition and the lack of medical records. They didn't even make a mention when they talked to the investigator of that issue that you just talked about this issue with the power of attorneys.
But my understanding was his excuse for why he didn't inform the court that it had been revoked was he considered that a nullity because she wasn't competent. Do I have that wrong?
Yeah, his position was the reason why he thought he could just file it and say it's purported and not file the other ones is because he's deeming that the other power of attorney to Mr. Richards was invalid. That's correct. So,
sir, if I could just ask, during the sanctions aspect of the hearing, Mr. Pollack said, because again, although I violated these rules, as the record makes clear, truly, I don't believe anyone's been harmed by it. That's just it. What do we do with that statement, even though it was made in the sanctions part of the case? He seems to admit that he violated the rules.
That is troubling. I noted that, and I guess there's one he doesn't state what rule he's violating. I don't know the answer to that. So that would be answer to that, and the other would simply be if he tries to admit he violated a rule, but he didn't. Like, I'll use an example. Let's take the check, for example. If he's saying he violated the rule, if that's what he's referring to, because he left the attorney at law on his check when he paid for the subpoena to the clerk. If that's going to be a per se, violation of the rules, which I'm not, to me, it's not clear whether it is or isn't, in all honesty. There's not a lot of case law on any of these type issues. But in reading how the bar usually treats that, not making you scratch that out everywhere, I don't see that as a violation. So if he's admitting that was a violation, but it really isn't a violation, I guess the question would be, can he admit to doing something that really isn't a violation? So I guess that would be the response I would have. So getting back to my argument is in focus on this, one of the issues was that was brought up in the reply brief was that he waived a lot of arguments, getting back to some of this waiver issues, and with not citing a lot of cases in his initial brief. And I would point out these facts in this case are very unique, even with the respect to the issue with the check and the writing of the phrase attorney at law being on the check. The state bar found cases in California and Kansas, but they're not even directly on point. There's just not a lot of law addressing these issues. So this is really more of a factual applied to the rule issue, and there's just not a lot of case law with these specific set of facts, because it really is a very odd set of facts, because it's not something that would normally, you know, that happens very often.
I agree. It's probably unlikely you'll find a case where a lawyer sleeps in the person's house, and when he's not sleeping in the house, his wife is sleeping in the house.
It's undoubtedly there's bad facts, but bad facts shouldn't make bad law. And I look at I'm trying to just look at the rule and focus on the rule. And I look at what he did, it comes down to the focus is on his petition and was it filed in bad faith, primarily other than the check issue, And the best evidence we have is the Judge Iden's order. And I understand that the attorney is guardian ad litem and the attorney representing Ms. Kearney want to sit there and go, oh, I disagreed with it, but I signed it anyway. Judge Iden may have disagreed with it. Judge Iden may have said, I didn't know what purported meant. And I was being completely fooled in that thing. And I don't like what he did. If he didn't like it, he shouldn't have signed the order, because he signed an order saying that he felt like in the end, in looking at all that happened, that what he did was in good faith and for the benefit of his client. And I think that, and I don't see where that is addressed enough in the three-judge panel. It's almost like it's just kicked to the side, and it's the most important piece of evidence. It's the judge speaking. And I see I've got about 17 seconds, so I think by the time I start, I'll go ahead and sit now. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, good morning. My name is Robert Claiborne. I'm here with my co-counsel, Cooper Vaughn, from the Attorney General's office, and we represent the appellee, the Virginia State Bar. As this court observed the last time Mr. Pollack was before it, about 2 years ago, he has a roughly quarter century of history of state bar discipline. That includes three suspensions, one being the one this court affirmed the last time he was here, two of those being within 2 years before the three-judge panel's decision here, a public reprimand, and a private reprimand. The misconduct now at issue before this court occurred after the court's affirmance of that suspension, and one of those instances of misconduct went into after that suspension went into effect. That resulted in a revocation of his bar license. He's back here before this court, and the court should affirm. First, Your Honor, there is insufficient briefing which waives the assignments of error that Mr. Pollack has presented. He's conceded that he waived the first three assignments of error, and he's withdrawn those on his reply brief. The remaining 10 boil down to three categories. Those are the sufficiency of the evidence that he was not candid toward the tribunal, that he committed misconduct before it in the Clark County Circuit Court. Those are assignments of errors 4 through 10 and 12. There's also category 2, the sufficiency of the evidence that he was untruthful in calling himself an attorney at law, paying a check to the clerk of the Clark County Circuit Court, even though he was suspended at the time. And then category 3, assignment of error 13, the matter of the imposition of his sanction of suspension. On the matter of waiver, Your Honors, really his opening brief is more of a regurgitation of his assignments of errors. There's a very minor amount of case law peppered in, and he superficially engages with the law. The reply brief does elucidate a little bit more. However, under Palmer versus Atlantic Coast Pipeline, this court's decision, he cannot raise arguments for the first time on reply brief. He really tries to do that in arguing that he was not practicing law when he used the check. However, that was not elaborated upon earlier in the court in his opening brief or at trial. That argument is also defeated on the merits, because a lawyer representing himself is subject to the rules of professional conduct. That's made clear in Legal Ethics Opinion 1890. As well as Barrett versus Virginia State Bar decision of this court in 2006, with which both parties cite. On the matter of the lack of candor and his misconduct toward the Clark County Court, those are assignments of errors 4 through 10 and 12. Even if we do get to the merits, they do not support reversal. He lacked candor when he filed the petition with the Guardian Conservator and called himself her attorney in fact, and he did that on page 1. I realize opposing counsel mentions the reference to purported attorney in fact, a purported power of attorney on page 2 of that pleading. However, when we're looking at the totality of the circumstances here, again, moving into the house of this woman after he's sort of taken on the engagement based off of, sort of an idea of recovering money for a lottery ticket winning, makes himself power of attorney. There's back and forth with her neighbor, Barnett, who'd been assisting her when she tried to become the power of attorney and attorney in fact. This back and forth where he is not responding to those concerns, making himself attorney in fact, moving in. And then the timing of the petition as well is very important, and I think that was noted by the trial court as well, or the three-judge panel, rather. He filed it the same date that Ms. Carney's attorney, Keith Richards, notified him of the notice of no trespass and no contact. Almost immediately after receiving it, Pollock informs Richards that he's going to file the petition. He circulates the draft petition, which in that draft identified Richards as someone purportedly holding a power of attorney. However, then he proceeds to file it, and he omits any reference to Richards and supposedly cleans this up by saying it's purported on page 2 while still calling himself, without any qualification, the attorney in fact on page 1. These circumstances were all entirely before the three-judge panel. They reviewed it. They found that he was not candid, that he did engage in misconduct in filing this. Moreover, the notice of no trespass, no contact was not attached. And so there's certainly more than sufficient evidence to support the three judge court's finding on this. Furthermore, there's argument that this was a durable power of attorney, so therefore the incapacity, which Justice Russell alluded to, that is supposed to have occurred, but it seems the only intervening event was the notification of the note of the revocation and the no contact. However, that revocation, moreover, could have been accomplished whether or not she was incapacitated. There's a separate statutory right for her to make that revocation on her own, which is what happened. I think a lot of the appellant's arguments get into Rule 3.1 questions of meritorious claims. However, we're not here on that issue. We're talking about his misconduct and lack of candor. Whether or not there's a good faith basis to say that she was in a mental state to deserve guardianship and conservatorship is completely a separate issue here. Whether or not the agreed order, which was endorsed by the parties to move the matter forward, whether that said good faith in it is not at issue here. That does not bear on whether he lacked candor or whether he committed misconduct. Pages 9 through 10 of our brief also, furthermore, even if there were a question and that good faith language did seem to matter, we walked through the statutory scheme of 64.2, 2003A, and 2008A, which show that there is an internal inconsistency insofar as a good faith finding could be made. The guardian ad litem fees, those could only be awarded upon a finding of bad faith, and they were in that case. So that is the substantive component of the order. If we're looking within the four corners and we have to reconcile it, we look at what was actually ordered, the meat of it, and that was the payment of attorney fees, which required good faith, required bad faith, and defeats the self-serving statement of good faith that Mr. Pollock included in it. The category two, whether he was untruthful in writing attorney at law on his checks and or having it printed on his checks and paying that check to the Clark County Circuit Court. This is again supported by the record and the law. Suspension is a forced removal, but temporary from the office of law. When you are a suspended attorney, you're not supposed to.
Counsel,
yes, Your Honor.
In Barrett, this court stated that a lawyer whose license is suspended is still an active member of the bar. Of course, that was for purposes of saying Mr. Barrett could still violate the rules while in suspension. And while it's not law, the bar's website indicates that a lawyer may pass out his card indicating attorney at law at CLEs, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm having difficulty finding this particular allegation meets the rule of making a false statement if the attorney is still an active member of the bar, even though suspended. Help me with that.
Yes, Your Honor. And to address Barrett first, I agree. There is a portion where it acknowledges you are removed from the office of law, albeit temporarily. It also says you're a member of the bar for purposes of being disciplined there. The attorney was practicing pro se, and he was disciplined there. I think that's a distinct situation here, and I think the state bar FAQ highlights that in some sense. And I think the exact language is, can I hand out business cards? And the response on the FAQ is, yes, provided no, this is the exact language, no misrepresentations are made regarding the suspension and or the suspended lawyer's authorization to practice law. So while that FAQ does not expressly address if you had attorney at law on your business card, I believe the fair reading of that is that, yes, it would be a misrepresentation of the suspended lawyer's authorization to practice law to say attorney at law without any further clarification. That's
so
further.
So your position would be, as they're handing out the card, they have to explicitly say, but I'm currently suspended and you can contact me 6 months from now?
Your Honor, and I suppose that could clean up the problem with the card. I think it would be better to not hand out a card that said you were attorney at law. As in this case, it was acknowledged in the trial court testimony that he could have crossed out attorney at law.
But is he not still an attorney at law, though suspended? He's a suspended attorney.
He's suspended. He is temporarily removed from the office. He may return. He is a suspended attorney. So for bar status, he is considered active, but that's an internal bar mechanism focused on his discipline. The suspension.
Does it matter what the card or the check was used for? So in other words, if I see someone in the courthouse who's talking about they need a lawyer and I'm suspended and I hand them my business card, that creates a certain context that suggests, hey, I'm here to represent you versus some other context. And here, the checks were used to pay for subpoenas for this case, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe there's prefatory language in the rule. I don't have it right in front of me, but effectively it says in the course of representing a client, here he was pro se, and that would apply under Barrett in the previous reference legal ethics opinion I mentioned. But getting back to the card and the testimony here as well, we cited it on our brief, Joint Appendix 453, 458 through 62. There's back and forth between Mr. Pollack and the court when they're asking about this. He acknowledges, yes, I should have removed it. He has some sort of an excuse that, well, I didn't know it was on the car. I didn't know it was on the check. They ask him, well, how long have you had these checks? For a long time. The court, in sort of making its findings, it had the testimony of Mr. Pollack before it. It saw his demeanor, judged his credibility, and
Is the test what a reasonable layperson listener would take from the statement, I am an attorney at law?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that it would be a layperson. We are dealing with the rules of professional conduct. I think it's important to take into consideration.
If the standard here is it a misstatement? Is it deceptive? Then, I mean, wouldn't the audience matter as well? Now, I mean, it would strike me that if somebody represents that they are an attorney at law, that would suggest to a reasonable listener that they are a fully empowered, can practice law attorney at that moment. I am, present tense.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I suppose there are sort of we are focused on attorney conduct. We're all focused on how attorneys deal with the public and interact with the public. I think getting back to Barrett too, Barrett is talking about, are you subject to the rules of discipline? Barrett is not saying yet how you can represent yourself to the public, and that is a very important purpose in how we regulate attorneys in Virginia.
The rule is make a false statement of fact or law, and I'm assuming that the allegation is he made a false statement of fact.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that that level of detail was got, or that distinction was made in the trial court's decision. I could see it being viewed as a mixed question of law and fact. There's the factual, obviously the underlying facts of is he suspended, and then the legal meaning of what it means to be a misrepresentation. What are the elements of the misrepresentation? How that translates.
But on the factual question, isn't the question, and whether it's an objective standard or a reasonable layperson standard or whoever the reasonable listener is or receiver of the information, whether they would understand attorney at law to include the class of people who have passed the bar at one point in their lives, or would it include and all of them, no matter what their current status is, or would it be whether they would understand it to be, if you say, I am an attorney at law, that you are fully empowered at law to do the acts that only an attorney can do?
Fully empowered, Your Honor. Moving, Your Honors, to the matter of the revocation, this is fully supported by the record and by the lengthy history of Pollock's bar discipline. The court noted Joint Appendix 168, three-judge panel sort of sums up their statement of what they viewed as Mr. Pollock's history of misconduct. It really evinced a lot of sort of these statements, I committed no harm, I didn't know, or this was a technical violation, really showed a failure to appreciate that, what he had done. Also, this was, very important, this was a very vulnerable woman who was in sort of very elderly woman who was wheelchair bound, seeking help from someone, moves into her house. Some very strange circumstances, starts making himself her power of attorney, and then sort of makes a snap judgment once he hears that it's revoked, that he needs to make himself, through his own pro se filing, her guardian ad litem, and then starts changing the way he represents who's an attorney in fact, who's a competing attorney in fact, in his drafts with opposing counsel, with her attorney, and then also ultimately in his filing. And then, of course, it's important too that he non-suited the filing, and that was immediately upon the guardian ad litem's issuance of discovery, seeking sort of his justification. I think the trial court's summary summed it up well. No harm, no foul is not the standard. He has harmed people, and this court should affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, you have 3 minutes and 12 seconds for rebuttal.
Mr. Claiborne, on behalf of the State Bar, he just indicated or stated that Judge Iden's order, does not bear on whether Mr. Pollock committed misconduct. But that, and I couldn't disagree more, that charge is candor towards the tribunal, and it's the court. Well, and it's the court is
what do we do? What do we do with part of the order that awarded the fees?
It doesn't award them based on it was two sections of the code, 64.2-2003, and is what it was awarded under, and that doesn't have a bad faith finding on it. And there's no bad faith. You can't even imply it from that. They weren't awarded under 64.2-2008. And so the judge didn't. If he'd have wanted to say it was bad faith and that's why I gave them to him, then he could have done that. And it's more of the nature of a consent order with Mr. Pollock agreeing to pay the fees. So whether that was under the statutes or not, but they indicate it was under 64.2-2003, not 64.2-2008, and that's an important distinction. So, I mean, the order is the judge, in effect, is the victim in this case, and it's like the three-judge panel doesn't address that. They acknowledge that order's out there, but they don't address how they distinguish that from other bad facts, like the fact that he stayed at her house.
Have to distinguish it at all? They can just say to themselves, I don't agree with that.
I missed the first part of your question. I'm sorry.
Why does the three-judge panel have to distinguish it at all? All they have to say is, I just don't agree with that. I think he clearly did not have candor. And if you thought he did, you're wrong. Well, why is that not the answer to this question? I don't know why we're even arguing about it.
Because their finding needs to be based on facts, and the most important fact is the judge's order, and he's saying
it's good
faith.
Well, a witness can come into court and say, in a criminal case, anything he or she wants to say, but if the facts otherwise provide a basis for conviction, the criminal witness, the complaining witness, is not going to be dispositive in the case.
Well, I understand that, but the most important fact in this case is his order, which is effectively his testimony.
The three-judge court is the fact finder here, mm-hmm. not Judge Iden, correct?
That's correct, yes.
So if they don't accept his characterization of the record, which, as we've discussed, may actually stretch whether it's his characterization or not, he signed it. If they are the fact finder, they're not bound by it, as we've discussed. So what difference does it make if the other evidence supports their conclusion?
I guess I would point out that is that clear, meet a clear and convincing standard when the most important witness in the case, the judge, who's the candor is involves, is saying it's good faith. He had a chance to say otherwise. He didn't need to sign that order. He knows Mr. Pollack. He practices in that area all the time, and he chose not to.
Well, so. Under that theory, unless the judge imposes sanctions under 801-271.1, the bar can never charge lack of candor to the tribunal, because that's a sanctionable event, but the judge didn't enter sanctions.
I just ran out of time. I don't know if you want to answer.
Can
sure,
answer
you can
that
answer
one?
The question.
I don't know that I would. The answer would be no, because then it gets back to something point you made earlier about it's just another piece of evidence. It's just a fact. So that would just be another piece of fact that would go in just like here. But to me, it's the most important fact. Thank y'all.
Thank you, counsel.